Welcome everyone to the 2008 version of the Trottier Symposium. The second task is to introduce both the panelists for this year and the theme of the conference itself. For when you think of ethics and the discussion of ethics, then you will naturally think of philosophers and theologians who have debated ethical issues for hundreds and indeed thousands of years. Much more recently, however, two other schools have joined in the debate, and these are economists and evolutionary biologists. Economists working from the point of view of rational decision-making, evolutionary biologists working from the point of view of processes governed by natural selection. These two schools have introduced fresh vigor into discussions of ethics, and yet they remain far apart. Economists primarily relying upon the selfish interests of individuals, evolutionary biologists relying on the selfish interests of genes. It's unusual to see the two in combination, so it's an extremely interesting event when we have two eminent economists and two eminent evolutionary biologists together in the same place to discuss this issue which is so central to the organization of human societies. So we're very pleased to be able to introduce to you our two economists, Ted Bergstrom and Paul Seabright, and our two evolutionary biologists, Manfred Malinsky and Stu West. And this is not, I haven't procured these photographs in any underhand fashion. They're from the website, Stu. Ted Bergstrom is the Aaron and Cherie Resnick Chair of Economics at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And the reason that we really wanted to know what his opinion on the matter was is that he has pioneered the use of experiments in economic analysis. And this is an unusual line of investigation for an economist and an extremely rewarding one. As the quotation here points out, it can also be a rather double-edged one. He's written a textbook on the field and is one of the primary international authorities upon experimental economics. Dr. Manfred Malinsky is Executive Director of the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Biology at Plön in Germany. He is best known for having pioneered the use of game theory in the study of evolutionary processes, in the study of decision-making by animals and indeed decision-making by plants. And he's worked extensively on how cooperation can evolve even in populations of organisms, each of which has purely selfish interests. His biological work, which we heard in a seminar in the biology department, refers to how sticklebacks choose their mates according to detecting their immune system genes. But he has also applied evolutionary principles, to major social questions such as why the ocean is overfished or why we're unable to develop successful climate change policies. Dr. Paul Seabright is a microeconomist at the Department of Economics in Toulouse. He has very extensive interest in microeconomics, including particularly regulation, competition policy, how organizations are structured, and he has a track record of working with the most important of international organizations, including the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, World Bank, European Commission, and so forth. He also, and this is why I know of his work, published a remarkable international bestseller, The Company of Strangers, which I have here to refer to throughout his talk, in case he says anything different, which describes how trust-based social systems can develop, even in circumstances where apparently trust doesn't pay. And finally, Dr. Stuart West is Professor of Evolutionary Biology at the University of Edinburgh, shortly moving to the University of Oxford, and he has pioneered the study of social behavior in a very different group of organisms, social behavior of microbes, particularly of bacteria, whose social complexities have yet to be explored very thoroughly. And his work can help us to understand how helpful behavior, trustworthy behavior, can evolve even in the simplest organisms and the principles that regulate that evolution. So there are panelists this evening. They will make a series of short presentations after I've finished to describe their own points of view. We shall then gather here at the table, and I will ask some probing questions designed to bring out the differences, if any, between economists and evolutionary biologists. And I hope that we'll find out whether or not there are indeed any irreconcilable differences between the two points of view, or, much more interestingly, whether we can agree on fundamental similarities. After that, we shall be open to questions from the floor. These will be written questions, so there will be runners going up and down the galleries handing out question cards, which you can fill in with a question. That's returned to the runner to come down here, and Dr. Brian Alters will then be responsible for asking questions to the panel. When the question period is finished, then we have a reception at the Redpath Museum, which is just a very short walk away. That's the evening. So how can we begin? Well, we might begin in an optimistic way, I think. We might begin by saying that when we're thinking about the origin of ethical systems, what we're looking at is a system which is, at its inception, an honest and honorable and helpful system. And it is only the organization of people in large numbers into cities which has caused a degeneration. Wherever people gather in large numbers, they will compete. There will be envy. These will produce vices of different kinds. And we will observe a degeneration of morals and a degeneration of ethics. This is the point of view of the noble savage, memorably noted by Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And it pictures man in a state of nature as being also in a state of grace, and our fall from grace has been the consequence of our development of civilization. That's one point of view. A point of view still widely held, particularly in university sociology departments. Another and darker point of view might be had if we consider the evolution of Homo sapiens. We are a relatively young species. We arose just short of 200,000 years ago. This is the earliest skeletal remains we have of our own species. It comes from a valley in East Africa. Our species originated in East Africa and subsequently spread throughout the continent, which it occupied for the next 150,000 years. Most of our history is African. About 50,000 years ago, however, a small group of human bands broke out, probably in this area between Ethiopia and the Yemen, and proceeded to fan out through the world. First of all, the obvious coastal route down south eastern Asia towards Australia, much more accessible then because sea levels were low, and New Zealand. Australia was reached about 50 or 60,000 years ago. And then up into Central Asia, turn left for Europe, turn right for Central Asia, down for Southern Asia and China, across the Bering Strait into the Americas, and down to the tip of South America. And wherever we went, we discovered large, tasty animals. We discovered marsupials the size of ponies in Australia. We discovered mammoths in Northern Europe. We discovered giant beavers in primeval Canada. We discovered giant ground sloths in South America. And when the last landmass to be occupied by human beings, New Zealand, was discovered about 1,000 years ago, then those first settlers discovered an immense radiation of large ground-living birds, the moa. And almost immediately after we arrived, all of these animals met with misfortune. This could have been a coincidence or the result of climate change, but possibly not. Moreover, wild animals were not the only things that we discovered, because there were also people there, other species in the genus Homo. Homo erectus is our sister species. Homo erectus first appeared in Africa about 2 million years ago, spread through the continent, but then came out of Africa 500,000 years ago and spread throughout most of Eurasia, with quite large populations of humans occupying different parts of the continent. So when we arrived out of Africa into Eurasia, we found a land which was not empty, but already populated by Homo erectus. Shortly after we arrived, Homo erectus met with misfortune. Turning left into Europe, we found that already occupied by a very large-brained hominid, Homo neanderthalis, Neanderthal man, with a high cultural grade, including painting, fire, advanced tool-making, and clothes. Shortly after we arrived in Europe, Homo neanderthalis met with misfortune. We may consider that we are extremely good at writing piano concertos, composing epic poetry, discovering the scientific truths of the natural world, but what we are really, really good at is killing things. That is our history. And yet, at the same time, despite that history, in the past few thousand years, we have managed to construct astonishingly complex social organizations in large cities based on trustful social relationships and giving rise to an almost indefinite division of labor among people. How can this be? That is the question which has animated this symposium. That is the question which we're going to call upon the panelists to answer. And the first one up to the plate is Ted Bergstrom of the University of California. Ted.
Okay. It's a picture of where I work. I always show that when I go to places that are far north. So our charge for the debate on the little brochure you have is this. We know that the distinctive features of the human body, such as our large brains and nearly hairless bodies and dexterous hands, I'm not sure about mine, have evolved through natural selection. Our social behavior may have evolved in the same way, and perhaps with the same dexterity as my hands. The second point of view, however, is that our social behavior and the systems of ethics on which it is based are uniquely human and owe nothing to the processes that govern societies of ants or behavior. Our bodies may have evolved, but our ethics requires another kind of explanation. So my take on this matter is that, indeed, evolutionary thinking has a great deal to tell us about ethics and the presence of altruism among men and beasts. I think that game theory allows us to frame questions about ethics in a way that is more effective than is perhaps in the experience of many people. And I'm going to try to give you a little glimmer of that notion. As to the question, does ethics require another kind of explanation from that of the evolution of our bodies? Well, there's kind of a trivial answer. Of course, just as the evolution of our eyes requires a different explanation from that of our ears. For many people, that doesn't seem to be what they mean when they say that the evolution of that ethics requires a different kind of explanation. For many people, I think ethics is the kind of thing that very serious, solemn-looking people without a sense of humor pronounce, here's what you guys should do. And you should do it because it's right, and it's right because I believe very deeply that it's right. That's not the kind of ethics I'm going to be talking about. I'm interested in notions of ethics as conventions. How do people expect each other to behave? How do they expect themselves to behave? And the same questions apply to animals in many instances. Sometimes these similar solutions that animals have found to our solutions probably come from the same roots. Sometimes it's parallel evolution. I can't tell you that. Another difference between the evolution of ethics and the evolution of our ears and eyes is the notion of cultural evolution. So we inherit the patterns for our bodies in a very direct way from our parents. We can inherit ideas from others, from our teachers, from our from our cohorts. The paths of transmission for rules about how to behave, for conventions, are different, or can at least be different, from the genetic path. Although that's true, there are also similar rules of selection. Some social rules work well, and societies that adopt them prosper and pass on their rules. Some rules work badly and are not transmitted very much. The rules that get transmitted most frequently needn't be rules that are efficient, but often they are. And there's a very, very interesting body of study there, one we won't have time to spend much, or won't be able to spend much time with today. I do want to talk about some ideas of competing golden rules to kind of show you why I think that looking at things with the tools of game theory and natural selection are quite powerful. So everybody's familiar with this version of the golden rule, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, in the Old Testament. There's another one, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. They both sound pretty much the same, particularly on a sleepy Sunday. But if you want to think about them, they don't say the same thing. One rule is an exhortation towards extreme sympathy, care about thy neighbor, love thy neighbor. The other is to an extreme version of symmetry. Act as you would if you wanted to be copied. So a couple questions that arise are, in what way are these rules different, or are they different? Another interesting question, I think, why are they so extreme? Why do these rules demand love thy neighbor totally as well as thyself? Is that realistic? Do people really do that? Do they really act as if they would want, exactly as they would want others to act towards them? Mostly we don't act like that. Why did these, are these nutty? Where did they come from? Why are they so extreme? And we'll try to approach that question, sneak up on it from one side, look at it from another, and so on. So these rules are common to many cultures. The love thy neighbor rule, for example, is expressed by the Taoists as regard your neighbor's gain as your gain and your neighbor's loss as your loss. The do unto others rules, the command for symmetry, Confucius says it in the negative way, never impose on others what you would not choose for yourself. Aristotle says it, I think, in an interesting way, and this could be regarded as a definition of friendship. We should behave toward friends as we would wish friends to behave towards us. Kant says it in a more officious way, act only according to the maxim whereby you can at the same time will that it should become a universal law. If I had a more dignified demeanor, it would sound better. Now, there's a curious contrast to what the biologists say, or what has become, well, the standard in biological ethics. This is known as Hamilton's rule. But Hamilton's rule is not an entreaty to behavior. It's an observation. It's a report on how creatures are like, or what he figures they will be like, given their evolutionary background. And so he maintains that evolutionary principles predict that for sexually reproducing species, the social behavior of a species evolves in such a way that in each distinct behavior-evoking situation, the individual will seem to value his neighbor's fitness against his own according to the coefficients of relationship appropriate. So you're valuing the welfare of your neighbor. Indeed, the welfare is defined very explicitly. It's your reproductive fitness, long-run reproductive success. You value that according to how closely you're related with the other creature. And how does that work in a little more detail? Oopsie. Why did I skip that? Okay, so in general, these golden rules all are, some of them fudge a very serious question. Just who is my neighbor? What is the set of people to whom I'm exhorted to treat as myself? And it's pretty clear with the Old Testament version and the Taoist version and the Aristotle version that the set of people that are entitled to such consideration is restricted. It's one's neighbors or friends. Confucius and Kant seem to be more universal in their statement. Actually, in the New Testament, the question is asked, who is my neighbor? And we get the parable of the Good Samaritan, which I think is a little weaselly on the question. So it turns out the Pharisee asks Jesus, who is my neighbor? And Jesus tells the story about the Good Samaritan, who, well, the man by the side of the road who was beaten by robbers, a stranger comes along, a Samaritan of a different ethnic group, and he rescues the beaten man, takes care of him, and so on. And then the answer is, who is my neighbor is, the Good Samaritan is my neighbor, which I find a little odd because this says, the guy who is nice to me is my neighbor, but just to whom should the Good Samaritan be nice is not quite so clear, I think. At any rate, Hamilton, on the other hand, is very specific about the who is my neighbor, what is the domain of my generosity, but not very generous. In effect, individuals have sympathy only for their relatives, and that only proportional to their relatedness. So in fact, we can contrast the golden rules with Hamilton's rule. So when should you take an action that costs you C and benefits somebody else by B? And the golden rules say, do it if the person is a neighbor and if B is bigger than C. And Hamilton says, do it if and only if R times B is bigger than C, where R is your coefficient of relatedness. Well, just what is this coefficient of relatedness? It's the probability that if you have a rare mutation, so will the other person. Okay. So for full siblings, a brother and sister, their degree of relatedness is 1/2. Sexual creatures. For half siblings, it's 1/4. For cousins, it's 1/8. It's 1/2 between a parent and a child, and so on. Nearly zero for a random stranger. So, in effect, Hamilton's rule is quite a long mark from the golden rule. So we might again pose the question, are golden rules really unrealistic? So certainly, my brethren in the field of economics think so. We model Homo economicus, who doesn't give a damn about anybody other than himself. And he's a good friend of ours. Turns out his behavior predicts a lot of human behavior very well. It works extremely well to predict the behavior of our colleagues. Now, presumably followers of Hamilton's rule also think these golden rules are very far from realistic for what you would expect of humans. You'll only value your brother's well-being at half your own, not at full value. And as for strangers, economists are right. So the question arises, are golden rules just empty preaching? Is this the kind of thing that these solemn guys pronounce? They don't really believe it, but they hope their congregation believes it. Or is there more to it? Is there a more fundamental reason why people should be more generous than Hamilton's rule suggests? And I'm going to return to that question in a little bit, presuming I don't run out of time. But before doing that, I want to discuss a little bit more the usefulness of the game theoretic setting for studying ethical questions. So Hamilton, when he proposed his Hamilton's rule, he was considering a very special class of game in which the cost to you and the benefit to the other player of your action doesn't depend on what the other guy is doing. So what it costs me to help you doesn't depend on how you're behaving, and for that matter, how much good my help does you doesn't depend on what you're doing. In this environment, the two versions of the golden rule are equivalent. But in more general games, they're not. And I just want to show you one example, give you the flavor of this kind of problem. So consider the quite famous game known as the Prisoner's Dilemma game, where the payoff to each of us depends on our own action and the action of the other. And suppose the two strategies are called cooperate and defect. Now, we'll make the payoffs so I've written them down here. What happens with these payoffs is if we both cooperate, we're both better off than if we both defect. But you know, if you cooperate and I defect, I'm better off than if we both cooperated. And you are worse off than if we both defected. So in that game, it turns out that no matter what the other guy is doing, the best thing for you to do, the selfish best thing for you to do, is defect. Whether he's defecting or cooperating, you'll get a higher payoff by defecting. On the other hand, the do unto others rule would say, oh, do what you would have the other do unto you. Well, each of us would like the other guy to cooperate, so the prediction of the do unto others rule is unambiguously cooperate in this game. On the other hand, the love thy neighbor rule says choose the thing that maximizes the sum of your payoff and the other payoffs. Remember, love thy neighbor as thyself. Treat his benefits as if they were your benefits. Okay? So that rule does not predict the same outcome as the do unto other rules, at least not in general. We can see that. For example, the love thy neighbor rule can lead to a trap where they both wind up defecting. Suppose that both players care equally about their own payoff and that of the other guy, of the neighbor, and suppose that the total payoff from to the cheater and the good guy, if I cheat and you're nice, the sum of our payoffs, suppose that's smaller than the sum of our payoffs would be if we were both nasty. Then, although it's true that we would both be better off, if we were both nice than if we're both nasty, let's suppose that this happens. Then there will be an equilibrium where we both defect. If the other guy is defecting, okay, I'd get P, the defector's payoff if I defected, but if I cooperated, he'll be better off, but his gain will be less than my loss. And if I love him exactly as much as I love me, I would still choose to defect. So we would stay in the defect. There also would be an equilibrium where we both cooperate, but we could get trapped in the both defect. Now, that's not the only thing that can... So in that case, you might say, oh, well, it looks like the do unto others rule is a better rule, and maybe there's reasons why societies would select for it. But in fact, we can have another circumstance where the love thy neighbor rule turns out to be the better. So suppose that we have another prisoner's dilemma, but this time the total payoff to me and you, if one of us is nice and the other nasty, is bigger than the total payoff if we're both nice. Okay? Then it would still be true with the do unto others rule, we both cooperate. But in the love thy neighbor rule, it would turn out that we do what maximizes the sum of our payoffs. Well, what's that? If you're cooperating, then I should defect. If you're defecting, I should cooperate. And so there'll be an equilibrium where we act in opposite ways for love thy neighbor. Now, in that case, in this particular game, it's set up, the payoff from the love thy neighbor rule is actually higher. Now, Hamilton's rule, how am I doing here? 2 minutes, okay. Hamilton's rule is, in a sense, a generalization of the love thy neighbor rule. At least he poses it as a generalization of the love thy neighbor rule. He says, act as if your payoff is your personal payoff plus your relative payoff multiplied by your coefficient of relatedness. It's love thy neighbor, love thy brother, but half as well as thyself. Love thy cousin 1/8 as well as thyself, and so on. It doesn't sound very good from the pulpit, but in a biology classroom. So, on the other hand, one could have a rule that's corresponds to the do unto other rule, where instead of loving thy brother half as well as thyself, treat your brother as if you think the probability is 1/2 that he will copy you. Okay? Treat your brother as if the probability is one half that he'll act the same way to you. That I call the semi-Kantian rule, okay? Full Kantian would say, do to your brother what you want him to do to you. Here, do what you would want to do if you thought you'd be copied with probability one half. In the simple additive games that Hamilton considered, these two rules result in the same behavior. But in general, they do not. In fact, it turns out that the logic of sexual reproduction indicates that the correct rule, at least for the most common model of sexual reproduction and genetic inheritance, is the semi-Kantian rule, not the love thy neighbor half as well rule. There are environments where the two rules lead to the same outcome, but when they differ, and there's some kind of spectacular and interesting cases where they do, the semi-Kantian rule seems to be the right one. Now, I wanted to return to the question, is Hamilton's rule too selfish? Why might evolution produce more altruism than Hamilton's rule predicts? So one clear interesting example is in relations between husband and wife, or monogamous partners. Essentially, their genetic fortunes are tied together. If they're truly monogamous, the man's reproductive success is exactly the same as the wife's reproductive success. They've got common interests, therefore, the Hamiltonian analysis applied in this situation says they should love each other pretty much like themselves. Her benefit is as much as mine. We have the same interests. If I promote her health or if she promotes mine, it comes to pretty much the same thing. Of course, some of you in California, it turns out, I'm sure you'll be shocked to hear this, marriage is not entirely monogamous. And so we don't have quite this 100% rule. There's also a very interesting other source of conflict, even among perfectly monogamous people. Okay, each has an interest in her kin, in her brother. She has an interest in her brother. Your no-good brother-in-law is her brother, and so on. There's always a conflict of interest with the in-laws. Your in-laws are her relatives, and so on. Finally, what I won't get time to spend on, So another source of greater altruism than we see in Hamilton's rule is the fact that a lot of life involves repeated encounters where you play with somebody over and over again. In such games, it's very likely that the players you play with are players that act in the same way as you do. If you're a cooperative person, you get a better shot at playing with cooperative people, and so on. If, in fact, this probability were exact matches of your type, you would play as a full Kantian.
And after an economist's point of view, we now have an evolutionary biologist, Professor Manfred Milinski from Cologne.
I study cooperative behavior in animals and humans in scenarios in which the interest of the individual is in conflict with the interest of a group. And such scenarios are called social dilemmas. From Darwin's point of view, we would expect that only those traits evolve that benefit the individual. Therefore, social dilemmas are dilemmas. The most famous one is the tragedy of the commons. Whenever people have free access to a public resource, the resource will be overused and collapse. Freedom in a commons brings ruin to all. And there are hundreds of examples where this happens, just a few. Overfishing of fish stock, the breakdown of health insurance systems, traffic jams, and so on. The decline or breakdown of the global climate by unlimited use of fuel and energy and unlimited production of CO2 is the most frightening one. Economists have developed a paradigm with which we can study this kind of dilemma experimentally. And I show you a simple example. Let's assume we have 4 volunteers and you provide them with money. For example, you give everybody 10 euros. Sorry, it's euros, not Canadian dollars in this game, but you can do it with Canadian dollars. And you ask each of them in each round whether they would be willing to contribute 1 euro to the public pool. And then you collect the money, double it, and redistribute it to the players. So 4 euros doubled is 8 euros divided by 4 is 2 euros each. That means that everybody has has a net gain of 1 euro. It shows that cooperation in this game, which did I say that? The public goods game pays off. Now let's assume there is one who does not contribute. So we have 3 euros on the pool, doubled 6 euros divided by 4 is 1 euro 50 per person. And you see that the 3 cooperators have a net gain of 50 cents each, but the single defector has a net gain of 1 euro 50. This shows you that defection in a public goods game, in a tragedy of the commons, pays off more than cooperation. And here we have 2 defectors, so now 2 euros in the pool, doubled, 4 euros divided by 4, 1 euro that each of the players receives. And you see that the 2 cooperators have no net benefit, but the 2 defectors have still a net benefit of 1 euro each. And here we have the most interesting case. There's just 1 cooperator. And you see, from this 1 euro, double 2 euros divided by 4, 50 cents is repaid to everybody. The 3 defectors still have a net benefit of 50 cents, but the single cooperator has a net deficit of 50 cents. And this shows you that from your own contribution to the public pool, you get less back than you have invested. So the rational strategy in a public goods game, the strategy that maximizes your personal income, is never to contribute anything. So Hardin was right. And we can demonstrate that this happens if you stage this game with volunteers. And there are hundreds of examples and they look all the same. Here you have groups of 6 players each. And they play 8 consecutive rounds of the public goods game. And you see they start with unpredicted cooperation. But this cooperation declines quickly over the 8 rounds. Now, many scientists have thought about conditions, additional conditions, under which the public resource may be maintained. This might help us in many of our problems. I had the following idea. Would the interaction of the public goods game with another game in which reputation is essential for receiving rewards help maintaining cooperation in the public goods game? So what kind of game might that be in which reputation matters? This is such a game, indirect reciprocity. In indirect reciprocity, a message from the Bible is verified. We have many citations from the Bible today. Give and you shall receive. But the Bible does not tell you whether you can expect anything back in your present life. Indirect reciprocity have 2 steps. A observes that B helps C. A helps B. That means you help those who have helped others. Or in other words, you help those who have built up a reputation for helping. But nobody really believed that such a strategy might evolve until Martin Novak and Carl Siegmund provided a theoretical analysis of this problem. They assumed that everybody has an image score, which is increased by 1 point after each act of helping and is decreased by 1 point after each act of withheld help. Now we need to know which minimum image score B has to have so that A would help him. And this is what they tested with a simulation of evolution in the computer. And they started with many strategies. I don't explain the figure in detail. I show you just the result. After 150 generations of evolution in the computer, one strategy survived. And this strategy means, this is called the zero strategy. You help everybody who has at least an image score of zero. So you help everybody with a positive image score. Nobody with a negative image score. It was tempting to test whether humans use such a strategy and achieve cooperation in an indirect reciprocity situation. We tested this prediction when I was in Switzerland, so our players were provided with Swiss money. We had 8 groups of 10 players each. Each group played 6 rounds with real Swiss money, so all these games are real money. What the volunteers earn in the game, they take home, and they have sometimes a profit and sometimes not, I must say. But you will see how this comes about. Each player was anonymous but had a pseudonym and was both a potential donor and a potential receiver once per round. The donor was asked whether he or she would give 1 Swiss franc, you can see that as well, 1 Swiss franc to another player who would then receive 2 Swiss francs. So we give 1 in addition. In each case, all players were shown the previous sequence of giving and not giving. For example, no, yes, no, which would mean an image score of -1, of the potential receiver. And they knew for sure that direct reciprocity was excluded. Now, the main result of the experiment. Now I'll show you the result of these 8 groups. And for each of these groups, you see 1 green bar, which shows you the average image score of receivers who received something, and a red bar, which is the average image score of receivers whom the donor refused to give. And you see in all but 1 case, the little one in the middle, the green bar is higher than the red bar. Or the green bar is not only higher, it is positive, whereas the red bar is negative. This means that receivers who had a positive image score received something, and receivers who had a negative image score did not receive anything. And overall, this result was highly significant. So we found that humans are prepared to give money to other humans of whom they knew that they had helped others. They gave money to people who had a positive reputation of helping. Now we are going to use this result for our actual problem. You know this result already. So we had 10 groups with 6 players each that played the public goods game, 8 consecutive rounds. And now there were 8 rounds of the indirect reciprocity game. And you see cooperation came up, which is as expected. But this is just the control. Now the actual experiment in the actual experiment, we had rounds of the public goods game and the indirect reciprocity game alternating. So we expect that people would not dare to demolish their reputation in the public goods game by not giving, because then they would probably not receive money in the following round of the indirect reciprocity game. So we expected that the decline of cooperation is slower. And now the result. And we were really surprised when we saw that. So the filled dots are again public goods rounds. And you see that the high initial level of cooperation in the public goods game was maintained throughout the whole experiment. So the interaction between these two games induced cooperation in the public goods game. And how did this happen? Now here you see that the probability to receive yes in the next round of the indirect reciprocity game depended on the behavior of a player in the previous round of the public goods game. So players who gave in the public goods game received with a high probability money from players in the indirect reciprocity game. Now after round 16, we had four rounds of the public goods game. And you see in the alternating treatment, the contributions declined a bit, but in the block game, there was a very high level of cooperation in these four rounds of the public goods game. Obviously, the players expected another block of the indirect reciprocity game to follow. Every second group was told from now on there will be only rounds of the group game until the end of the experiment. And you see, cooperation immediately declined. So the pending risk of another round of a game in which reputation matters motivated people to invest in the public good, and they maintained it. So this group that had the alternating game earned a lot of money. They were the winners in the end. But they could not do it by themselves. They needed this additional game interacting with the public goods game. Now we apply this insight to the big game. Preserving the global climate is a natural public goods game. All people on Earth take part in this game, you included. We asked groups of six students to invest in a climate public goods pool, either under the pseudonym, recognizable in the alternating indirect reciprocity game, as before, or they were completely anonymous. No name shown. The money in the climate public goods pool was, after doubling, not redistributed among the players, but used for an advertisement in a large, great German newspaper with information about the global climate and simple rules for reducing CO2 emission. Every second group received written expert information about the state of climate research from the Max Planck Institute of Meteorology. And we wanted to test whether reliable expert information can induce more cooperation in the sense that people are more prepared to invest in sustaining the global climate. Here I show you only the results of the public goods rounds. So there is always a round of the indirect reciprocity game in between. This is not shown. This is, as usual, not so interesting. The red dots show the money invested per group in the climate pool of those groups who were well informed about climate research. And the blue dots show the investment per group of those groups who had only a little bit information just to justify this advertisement in the newspaper. And you see, reliable expert information has an effect. There is highly significant difference between the red and the blues. But there is an enormous effect when we compare rounds in which the players made their decision in public, recognizable by their pseudonym. compared with rounds in which they were asked to invest anonymously. Well, this had a large effect. And we should learn from this effect. If people are prepared to invest in sustaining the climate, we should invent procedures that they can do their investment in a way that others can see it, not privately at home, where nobody can see it. And the general conclusions of all the experiments we have done is that people are prepared to behave altruistically when they know this can be recognized and they gain in other situations by this value, this currency that they can transfer from one situation to the next, which is reputation. So as soon as their reputation is at stake, they, in a moment, switch from selfish behavior to altruistic behavior. Well, that means if you do a donation, then it would not help your reputation to be recognized if nobody can see that. And you might profit from a donation that you made if you make it recognizable. And you all know that there are honest signals which had been invented for this purpose. You see, I made a donation. You see, these rules are already applied. I thank you for your patience.
Our next panelist, who is the economist Paul Seabright.
Thank you very much. In Graham's fascinating but distinctly non-vegetarian account of the history of our species, you might have been led to expect that the comparison apes or angels is about whether you take an elevated or a distinctly unelevated view of our nature and of our capacity for ethics. I'm firmly on the apes side of the answer, but I want to say that I have great respect for apes. In the interest of full disclosure, I should perhaps say that I'm an ape myself, so I'm probably biased. And none of my best friends are angels. But apes have extraordinary capacities, and I believe that we can learn a lot from the way in which apes behave about how we ourselves have put together this very elaborate piece of architecture, behavioral architecture, which is our ethical life. I'm going to take the question that we're invited to answer this evening as being a question about the role of evolution by natural selection in explaining our ethical beliefs and behavior. But for me, there's really two versions of that question, and there's an easy one, which I'm going to deal with very quickly, and there's a very difficult one. The easy one is, are our ethical beliefs and behavior as much a candidate for evolutionary explanation as most other parts of our bodies, brains, and behavior? But the really difficult question, and the really interesting one that I want to spend most of my time on, is which specific characteristics of our ethical beliefs and behavior have an evolutionary explanation? Let me deal with the first one. The answer is yes. Why is it yes? It's because, like many other aspects of our bodies, brains, and behavior, ethics is transmitted, certainly imperfectly, but with some degree of fidelity from one generation to another, and it affects our survival and reproduction. And if that happens, we have reason to think that it will evolve by natural selection. It will also evolve under other forces, notably cultural selection, about which I'll have something very short to say in a moment or two. But that it also has evolved by natural selection seems to me inescapable. We may have a debate about that at the end, but I don't propose to spend any further time defending that point of view. I would just point out a couple of riders to that. It's not as surprising as some people think that behavior should evolve by natural selection just because it's ethics. We're used to having natural selection explanations for behavior in many other fields. If you think about birdsong, about territoriality, about migration behavior, about puberty, the list is endless. The fact that it's behavior rather than a piece of your body doesn't make it intrinsically less a candidate for explanation by natural selection. And also, as I think now most of us accept, the fact that learning is involved doesn't rule out some role for genetic influences. We're used to the idea that natural selection designed some of our behavior as being relatively plastic, some of it as being relatively hardwired, as a function of the variability in the environment in which we were going to have to apply that. So I'm not actually going to say more about that. I'm going to try and answer the really difficult question. And to be honest, I think we know rather little about the answer to it. I think that there's almost no natural selection explanation for the specific characteristics of our ethical beliefs and behavior, which is entirely convincing yet. And so what I'm going to try and do is I'm going to try and set out a list of three types of property of our ethical life which have descending order of availability of convincing explanation. I'm going to set out a number of characteristics where I want to claim that we think there's pretty likely to be an evolutionary explanation for why our ethical life is like that. And we have some idea of what that is, even if there may be some uncertainty about the likely explanation. I'm then going to move on to a second list where I want to claim we can conjecture evolutionary explanations, but they remain very speculative, and for the moment there's very little positive evidence in their favor. And then I want to move to a third category where I suspect that there may just be no explanation, or more likely, a way I prefer to describe that predicament, is that it's likely that those particular properties of our ethical life are just byproducts of our evolution. They're byproducts of other characteristics of our brains and behavior which evolved because they were adaptive in other contexts. So let me give you these lists. The first list, which I'm just going to state this, I don't have the time to explain to you in detail why I chose these particular properties. But these are properties where I think we have pretty good reason to believe that there's an evolutionary explanation for why our ethical life is like that. The first and simplest point, which has been dealt with to a considerable extent by my two predecessors, is that we can behave unselfishly to others than our own kin. If anybody wants to discuss what the evidence is for that, I'm happy to take questions on that at the end. A second and slightly less obvious point is that our ethical behavior often feels rather impulsive, even though it's also strongly influenced by ideas. Imaginative literature is full of circumstances where people take ethical decisions in an impulsive way. One of my favorite examples is the famous passage in Huckleberry Finn where he's trying to determine whether to hand over the runaway slave Jim to the authorities, and he's facing the prospect that he'll go to hell if he doesn't. And then in a tremendously moving moment, he says, no, 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 I will go to hell, and he throws away the piece of paper. And that seems to show something about the way in which our ethical impulses can sometimes act as an override on forms of behavior we would otherwise have. And I think we have plausible evolutionary explanations for that. I'll come back to them in a moment. The third characteristic is that almost everybody, except for a very small number of sociopaths, has some ethical principles. Sorry, there seemed to be rather a lot in the audience. But, I took that to be nervous laughter. Most difficult ethical situations are not where there are some people without ethical principles and other people with, but where different people's principles conflict. And I think we have plausible explanations for that too. The fourth point is that many ethical systems are based around reciprocity. And remember, reciprocity isn't always good. It's about revenge, outrage, resentment. It's not just about generosity and altruism. And I think we have explanations for that. And finally, altruism and group solidarity often coexist with hostility to outsiders, to enemies. You'll have been struck by the very moving acceptance speech of Barack Obama when he was elected President of the United States. It was a wonderful moment, but was it about love for all mankind? No, it wasn't. There was an enemy, and he said, we will defeat you. Okay, this wasn't love all of mankind. This was love those in our group. We hope the remaining group, the out-group, is small, but we're going to defeat you. Now, let me try and say what I think are the elements which are common to the explanation of all of those features of our ethical life. For most of our evolution, human beings did not live in large cities. They lived in small bands, and they engaged in hunting and gathering. And hunting and gathering, I'd like to remind you, are very highly cooperative activities. And importantly, they're activities which demand a degree of autonomy and trustworthiness among those who undertake them. They're not like agriculture. Agriculture in many societies when it came in was associated with a substantial reduction in the autonomy of those who practiced it. Because you can plow a field, or at least you can pull the weeds out from a field more or less with a ball and chain around your leg, or at least with somebody watching you very closely with a whip. You can't hunt and gather like that. And it's clear that the societies in which we evolved for most of our evolutionary history were societies in which individuals had to be trusted. And the third thing, and this is where Graham's introduction is absolutely invaluable, is that human beings spent a lot of our prehistory, as well as much of our history, making frequent and very bloody warfare against other bands. That is now well established. I'm happy to argue that later if anybody doubts it. But I think there's no serious doubt now that the daily state of life in most hunter-gatherer communities was extremely risky and extremely violent. Now, the next thing that I'd like to emphasize is something not so much about the kind of societies in which we lived, but about us, about our bodies. And that is that evolution couldn't design human brains from scratch. It had to start with the existing material. In that respect, it's a little bit like a software program. I mean, nobody writes software programs from scratch. They start from something like MS-DOS, and when you look at what it eventually becomes, you see in the bugs of the developed program something about its origins. And so I think we learn quite a lot about why our behavior is like it is when we think about where it had to come from. The important point about those characteristics is that they give us an answer to why we evolved ethical beliefs that had those characteristics. And broadly speaking, there are two candidate explanations for why we came to have characteristics in our ethical life that were like that. What we needed to function effectively in those hunter-gatherer societies was the ability to be trustworthy and the ability to signal that trustworthiness to other people. We've heard a lot about signaling from Manfred, and signaling turned out to be very important, but it had to be important and credible. And it turns out that our endocrine systems are quite good ways of building into our behavior credible signals of our intentions. If I get really angry when I see certain behavior, somebody is cheating me, or when I'm accused of cheating somebody else wrongly, then it implies that I no longer am able to vouch for my behavior in the same peaceful way that I would have done before I got angry. And what we have good reason to believe is that our ancestors evolved capacities to be trustworthy, which were hardwired into their physiology, partly into their brain circuitry, but to a considerable extent into their endocrine systems, which acted as a device to allow others to trust them. Now, why would natural selection have worked that way? It would have worked that way to a considerable extent because of where it started from. We know, thanks now to brain imaging studies, that the much of our, the impulsive character that I described about our ethical life is reflected in the fact that many kinds of behavior involve an override of previously impulsive behavior. So, for example, when we see people making choices in a known environment, we see certain parts of the brain lighting up. When they have to think about whether to acquire information about that environment, to do more exploratory choices, then we see different parts of the brain lighting up in the brain scanner, indicating that what's going on is not a gradual refocusing of activity towards being more exploratory and less maximizing in terms of the existing environment, but rather an override mechanism that is kicking in saying, okay, switch off this existing behavior, switch on now a new form of behavior. And much of our ethical life seems to have that characteristic. We are in the grip of certain kinds of impulses and emotions, and then an alternative set of feelings or ideas kicks in and overrides what was previously going to be the decision that we would have made. Now, how do we think those things came about? There are roughly speaking, these are the slides, by the way, that are missing, so I'm inventing this, but it's consistent with what I said before. There are roughly speaking two candidate explanations. The first candidate explanation is that groups in which, for whatever reason, individuals could display cooperative, trustworthy behavior did better than groups that didn't. So this is the theory that says, within a group, nice guys finish last, but nice groups finish first. And now you'll see the connection with the hostility to outsiders, because a lot of nice groups in which people are cooperative with each other are not at all nice to other groups. Indeed, it's evident both from historical and prehistorical evidence that precisely the characteristics which most support and encourage solidarity within a small group in a hostile environment, such as, for example, the willingness to go into battle to defend your fellow members of the group, are the ones that make you the biggest danger to other groups. Sam Bowles and Jung-Kyu Choi, for example, have shown in a paper in Science, I believe, in 2 years ago, that the conditions under which altruism is going to be most selected for within groups are precisely the conditions under which hostility to rival groups will also be most adaptive. Okay, so the point about that kind of story is that it says it may not matter that being an altruist within the group is rather bad for you, provided that your group is under sufficient hostile attack from other groups that it will only survive if you manage to be altruistic. And that kind of story doesn't tell us where the original altruism comes from, but it tells us that if the groups without enough altruists are wiped out, the frequency of altruists in the population will be sustained. Now, for many people, that's not a satisfactory explanation. And the rival story points to the fact that we are essentially group living primates. And primates are species that, with some exceptions, live in groups that are highly status conscious and which spend a lot of their day-to-day activity forming small subgroups and coalitions. Again, to go back to the US presidential election, as soon as the election is won, we see the intense speculation about who's going to be in, who's going to be out, who's going to be favored, who's going to be disfavored. Primate groups do that, and they do that all the time. Now, if they do that, it starts to matter to you whether others will think you're an attractive addition to their coalition or to their subgroup. And if your trustworthiness is observable, as in the games that Manfred gave us, or if your makeup, including your endocrine system, predisposes you to behave in a way that other people can observe and can decide that they like because they want to have you as a collaborator, then your prospects in the coalition formation process in your primate band become immensely enhanced. And so what we have is the characteristics of the ethical life that I've described to you are essentially outgrowths of that feature, that we live in these primate bands which are forming subgroups and coalitions intensely all the time, and that to the extent that we have characteristics that can display our trustworthiness in a credible way, we become then more attractive partners for other people to join. Subject, of course, to the characteristic that what makes us more attractive to other members of our band can make us lethal and unattractive to members of rival bands. I have very little time left, so I'm going to skip rather quickly over the other two groups of properties that I mentioned. Here are some three properties of our ethical life which I want to suggest we have some speculative idea about evolutionary explanations for, but they're no more than that. The first is the intriguing feature that, whatever may be true today, most ethical systems have historically been associated with religious beliefs. Now, there's a popular view about why that's true, and that is that if you're being observed by an invisible spirit who can see what you do, then you become trustworthy because you're afraid of the consequences. Now, that may well be true. I don't want to dispute it as a possible story. What I want to dispute is how it can explain to us why we should be predisposed to have such religious beliefs in the first place. Because, after all, if you can imagine people who do think that they're observed by whoever it may be, I mean, it may be an invisible spirit, it could be the taxman. But if you have somebody who does that, then they will be law-abiding citizens, but at the same time, they will do less well than people who manage to shake off these beliefs and can not pay their taxes without fear of this invisible taxman. And I think we're still grasping for explanations for why ethical systems and systems of religious belief have been so closely intertwined. And my own view, for what it's worth, I have no time to defend it here, is that our openness to religious belief systems has a lot to do with the development of our large brains in ways that helped us to cooperate with others on the basis of promises of rewards in the distant future. We know that, for example, there's a lot of trading among other primate species. For example, chimpanzees trade food for sex, but they do it on an immediate basis. When chimpanzees trade food for sex, they want the sex now. They don't want it tomorrow or next week. Human beings are unusual, not just in trading food now for sex a long time later, but in general for being willing to put off the rewards of our cooperative behavior until a long time in the future. And I think that's part of the secret of why we're such cooperative trading species. But in addition, it's made us, in some sense, open to all kinds of promises, including promises from an afterlife. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing is not at the moment my concern. But this is something where we're in very speculative territory, but where, nevertheless, there's a remarkable feature of our ethical life that cries out for explanation. The second feature, I think, is that our most ethical systems have been historically associated with a high priority to norms of sexual behavior and much more for women than for men. And the reason there, I think, is the evolutionary explanation for that has been that when human beings began to form pair bonds, we were nevertheless living in groups in which the fragility of those pair bonds was very evident and very marked. And essentially that the consequence of this was that male cooperation took place not just for hunting, but essentially for keeping their women under control. That's part of the way in which male coalition behavior and male cooperative behavior evolved through prehistory, and even more so through history in agricultural societies where women were much more under the control of males. So I think that, again, offering the explanation of why those ethical systems developed that way isn't either to defend or to attack them. It's just to say that's how it came to be. And then I think, thirdly, the fact that most of our ethical systems have required individuals to respect very difficult injunctions or taboos. And there I think the speculative account, but important and plausible one, is that it's only individuals who are capable of respecting difficult injunctions and taboos that thereby signal that they have the commitment and the trustworthiness that makes them attractive partners in the enterprise of group living which we large brain primates undertake. Finally, this is the last slide, I think the most fascinating aspects of our ethical lives are those for which there are probably no evolutionary explanations. Many ethical systems enjoin us to treat strangers and not just friends and relatives and neighbors in a generous way. And I don't think there's any evolutionary explanation for that, for the simple reason that our frequent encounters with strangers have been a very novel feature of our evolution. It's something that's very, very recent. What I think has happened instead is that we have applied to strangers the logic of codes of behavior that apply to our neighbors and friends and relatives. And we do so because of a capacity in our brains to generalize, to reach out to the general case, which was enormously useful for us in other spheres of life, but which did not evolve because it was specially useful for us in ethics. Finally, I'd want to say many ethical disputes are highly stressful, and much more so than simple disputes about resources. That's mine, I want it. Well, it's a dispute, but it's not that stressful. When people have ethical arguments, they get really worked up about it. And the reason I want to suggest is that primate societies are societies in which being low in the status order is highly associated with stress. Cortisol levels in low-ranking monkeys and apes are extremely high. Now, the point about our ethical life is that it's extremely important for our ability to survive and prosper in the highly hierarchical primate societies in which we live. And I think that's one of the reasons why ethical disputes are indeed so stressful. Fortunately, not all ethical disputes, all ethical discussions are stressful. I find it extremely agreeable to discuss these things in a setting as we have this evening. And as one member of a primate species to many others, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to do so.
Our final panelist is our second evolutionary biologist, Stuart West.
So a very central feature of today's debate, which really hasn't been touched upon that much so far, is are humans special? And this is really what I want to discuss today. And in particular, are our social behaviors, which are the systems of which are the product of our ethics, uniquely human? And I want to discuss this by asking four questions about what is special in humans. And I should say at the start that I don't think we're the same as every other animal out there in the world. But I do think that we are different in ways that most people might not realize. And in particular, that we're not that different in some ways that people think we are quite different. And so I'm going to start off by asking three questions from a sort of evolutionary perspective about why what we do. And this is three areas where I think people think that you can often see it read or said that this is why we're special. First of all, we're special because we're more altruistic than other things. Second, we're special because we cooperate between non-relatives. Third, we're special because we enforce cooperation with punishment and policing. That's what ethics does, basically. Then after addressing those, I'm going to quickly move on to a fourth question from a more sort of proximate mechanistic angle, and saying, are we especially sophisticated or different in what we do? Do we have extra special cognitive systems? At this point, I should say that I realize my slides look like they were designed by a 9-year-old girl. And the reason for that is they were. My daughter abuses me that my PowerPoint presentations are really tedious and dull and not snazzy. And so I offered her this opportunity to see what would happen if I let her do the backgrounds afterwards. And I'd be very interested in any feedback on how this has worked. And so the first question is, are humans especially altruistic? And in order to answer this question, I've first got to say, what exactly is altruism? And as was touched upon earlier by Ted, altruism is a behavior which is costly to the actor that performs it, but beneficial to another individual or other individuals, the recipient or recipients. However, crucially, from an evolutionary perspective, altruism is defined over the long term. It's the total consequences of that behavior, and not with respect to any small group, with respect to everyone in the population. And so that means lots of things which are often referred to as altruism, so for example, reciprocal helping, helping to avoid punishment, helping to signal your quality, aren't actually altruistic. And the reason for this is they give you a benefit in the long term. And so they're actually mutually beneficial, helping or cooperative behaviors. And actually, if you really look at things that are really classified as altruism, then the answer is no, humans aren't especially altruistic. In fact, there's many organisms out there that are a lot more altruistic than us. The classic examples are, of course, the social insects, such as termites up there. We've got the huge termite nest, several times taller than the person standing next to it, and also the social hymenoptera, the ants, the bees, the wasps. And in all of these species, there's a sterile worker caste who basically lives within the colony and just helps the queen reproduce, okay? They're completely sterile. They do not breed. They give up any chance of reproducing themselves to help others. This is the most altruistic behavior possible, okay? So I'm sure many of you know about that already. But another thing is that you can even find altruism down in amongst microorganisms. And the other picture up here is a slime mold, Dictyostelium. And this is a small unicellular sort of thing, I guess, that lives in the soil. And when conditions are hard, the cells will come together and aggregate, and they will basically form a slug, which then travels through the soil to a point where it produces a fruiting body. And the pictures here, so I get quite confused, the two screens. The pictures here show the gradual formation of the fruiting body. And the key thing here is that there's two different types of cells in this. They're all originated from the same things, and one cell could have ended up being either of them. There's the stalk cells, which are the ones making the long, thin stalk, and then up there at the top, you've got the spore cells. The spore cells get to disperse, travel far, somewhere, find somewhere else where they can carry on living. But the stalk cells, that's the end of it. It's a dead end for them. Okay? So these cells are exactly like the sterile workers in the social insects. You have a sterile class in this species. And again, it's the same sort of explanations that's required in the social insects, that they're helping close relatives. In these slime molds, such as this, individuals that come together to form a fruiting body tend to be very close relatives. And in fact, in some cases, they even preferentially associate with closer relatives. And I just wanted to show you a picture of this because I think it looks quite cool. And so this is an agar plate where a lot of these fruiting bodies are being formed. There's quite a lot of them going on, so it's best to focus on one. And I recommend this sort of one that starts off pear-shaped here. And you can see it going up gradually into that fruiting body. And there's a lot of research going on to this at the moment. As you can imagine, there's... Sure, we've got selection for cooperation going on in there, but at the same time, there's a conflict. Everyone wants to be a spore cell and doesn't want to be a stalk cell. And we really don't know completely how they manage to do that and how this is stable yet. Second, so that's altruism. We're not more altruistic. Are we more special because non-relatives cooperate? Again, no, we're not. In a lot of cooperative breeding vertebrates, for example, meerkats that many of you may know from nature documentaries, unrelated individuals will come into groups and they cooperate. And the reason they do that is for similar to some of the things that have been discussed earlier. They will do it because there's selfish reasons to cooperating. And in fact, in the one that's often discussed a lot in terms of species such as this is group competition, the same issues that were being discussed together earlier in humans, that by helping your group do better, become bigger, your group does better, and so you're more likely to survive and reproduce yourself. However, maybe even more extreme and amazing is that there's a lot of examples in the natural world of when you get cooperation between individuals of different species. So this you could not be more unrelated. And the middle example here is examples of cleaner fish. So this is from reef, and you'll get some fish species who basically have little cleaning stations, and then their client fish will come along and they come and munch the parasites off them and let them wander away. Another example to show that you can even get it in amongst plants and bacteria is the other picture is the roots of a soybean, and the little round sort of nodule things on it are little bits where rhizobial bacteria live. And what they do is they fix nitrogen and give from the atmosphere and give it to the plant to help it grow. Okay, and so that's why things like soybeans and beans and peas are very valued by gardeners and in agriculture, because it's the bacteria that's fixing the nitrogen and helping the plants to grow, and essentially even putting it back into the soil. Third, are humans special because they enforce cooperation with mechanisms such as punishment and policing? I think this picture actually poses an ethical dilemma that's recently been solved in an interesting way in California a couple of days ago. Depending on the sexual orientation of this policeman, he may or may not be able to be married now. And again, the answer is no. Many organisms enforce cooperation with policing or punishment mechanisms. Meerkats, cuddly, lovely things on the television. But if someone gets pregnant and tries to breed while the dominant's doing that, she attacks them and evicts them from the group. Bees, again, social insects living in a lovely harmony within their colony. If one of the worker individuals tries to lay its own legs, then other workers or the queen will come along and destroy them. The bacteria, the rhizobia and soya bean example. If the rhizobia don't fix enough nitrogen in one of the root nodules, then the plant will cut off the oxygen supply to that nodule, which basically leads to the death and lack of ability to grow of the bacteria. And finally, with the cleaner fish example, the cleaner fish, actually, it's often more economical for them to, instead of eating the parasites on the fish, to nibble a little bit of the fish itself. There's more resources in the skin. And one of the reasons they don't do that is they get punished by their client if they do that. And again, I've got another little video of this, and I want you to watch this. And basically, here's the little cleaner. There's its big client. You can see it going along, and it's pretty obvious when it's doing what it should be doing, and it's eating the parasites, and then when it takes a nip from the fish itself. Behaving nicely. Okay. And there's two very nice features of this. There's been some really elegant experiments done on this. And one is that this punishment then makes the cleaner change its behavior. If they're punished for sort of stop eating parasites and taking a nip at the fish, they're less likely to do that in the future. But another thing is that different client fish will observe what's going on at the stations of different cleaner fish. And so what happens is that cleaner fish that tend to behave more cooperatively and don't cause problems will be visited more commonly. So in this species, these kind of interactions, you've got a mixture of partner choice and punishment, control and cooperation. So from these sort of evolutionary perspective, I don't think there really is anything that special about cooperation and helping behaviors in humans. But I think one thing that is very different is that we have much fancier and sophisticated proximate mechanisms. So, for example, we have very, as the three talks have shown before, we have very sophisticated mechanisms for rewarding cooperation and punishing those individuals that don't cooperate. And Manfred's experiments were a very nice example of that. Another one here is a similar public goods game where, as in his experiments, if you just keep playing a public goods game as normal, people gradually cooperate less and less over time. However, if you let people punish individuals that aren't cooperating, what you quickly see is that people do that. They take notice of who doesn't cooperate as much and they punish them. And that will then maintain cooperation in the system. And that is the really special thing that we can do. We can really fine-tune what we do to local conditions. And also with respect, we can really, as was also emphasized in the last talk, we can do that via social learning. Okay? We can teach, we can see, we can learn, we can see how other people do in a social group, what makes someone do well, what makes someone's group do well, and we can learn from that. And so, to go back to the answer, to go back to give an answer to my general question I gave at the beginning, are we special? I think from an evolutionary perspective, we're not that special. It's the same forces are involved. But from a mechanistic perspective, we have much more sophisticated ways of maintaining cooperative social behaviors. And ethics is one of those. So I think apes and other animals can tell us about why we have evolved ethics, but I think a really crucial point here and that I really want to emphasize is that we can't learn specifically from other animals why our ethics are exactly the way they are. And I think it's very wrong to try and take things out of the natural world and try to apply that to explain our ethics. If you want to, you can find an example of anything in the natural world. You can find infanticide. You can find siblicide. You can find male-female rape. You can find male-male rape. You can find anything. And that really, doesn't say anything about whether that's ethical in humans. Okay, thank you very much.
That concludes the first part of the symposium. For the second part, I'd like to invite the panelists to seat themselves at the table. So while you're thinking about what the panelists have been saying, what I'm going to do is start to try to get them to elaborate a little bit on the positions that they've taken up during the course of this symposium. And I'll start by saying that I think that there is a real problem here. And the problem is like this, that we've heard through many of the talks that we can construct models of how anything should behave in a certain situation, whether or not we should reciprocate, whether or not we should be cooperative, whether or not we should defect. And games like that can be played between students in a classroom, they can be played between animals in a natural environment, they can be played between bacteria in the soil. Does the fact that the same principles apply to behavior in all these organisms tell us anything about the evolution of human ethical systems? And I guess that I'll ask since he was the last to speak, I'll ask Stu West to respond to that first, if he could.
I guess my response to that is that we have a very general theory of natural selection that should explain the evolution of everything in any type of organism. And that's on one side. But on the other side, saying that we can show in a certain bacteria or a certain plant or a certain animal that cooperation is favored for this reason isn't the same as then trying to apply it more generally. And that is one problem of biology, that even though we're attempting to generalize all the time, we have to do so by sort of gradually adding specific test cases. And a lot of social cooperative behaviors will vary hugely. I mean, even in the animal world, across populations, you get hugely different levels in cooperation and the reasons for it. So which makes it very hard to generalize from explanations from other organisms to humans. Has that answered at all? I don't know.
Thanks, Stu. But I'm going to ask the question in an even harder-edged fashion. That is that when we see this sort of behavior exhibited by microbes or by plants or by nodules on the roots of plants, then obviously we can interpret this in terms of natural selection. But when we see similar sorts of games being solved by people, we know that they're using their brains to solve them. So I'm going to be not the devil's advocate here, but the angel's advocate. And I'm going to say that those biological studies do not tell us anything about human beings' ethical decisions are arrived at. Paul Seabright, would you have any comment on that?
Testing hypotheses about the evolution of ethics is in many ways harder than testing hypotheses about the evolution of our physiology. Ethics as a form of behavior doesn't leave skeletons. It leaves traces that, it may leave traces on skeletons. For example, there's a lot of evidence in the form of skeletons that bear the marks of violence, of anything from arrowheads to machete scars. Hominid skeleton can reveal the traces of another hominid's behavior. But I think it's fair to say that testing hypotheses about the evolution of behavior is a whole lot harder than testing hypotheses about the evolution of physiology, because you need, in a sense, to find a trail of evidence leading backwards. But the science of archaeology has become extraordinarily creative at putting forward and searching for the traces left by certain kinds of behavior. And I think it's very exciting. I always thought that archaeology was the kind of subject in which the second edition of a book would come out 100 years after the first. But it's extraordinary how fast techniques in archaeology are changing and are allowing hypotheses to be put forward and tested. Now, the fact that you can frame a hypothesis about behavior and look for certain predictions doesn't mean that you solve the problem easily, because there are frequently a multitude of behavioral hypotheses that are consistent with the same evidence of, for example, the way in which artifacts are left in a site, in a burial site, in a living site, and it's just patient detective work. But I think it's absolutely vital to resist the idea that because we're trying to explain how behavior evolves, and because past behavior has somehow evaporated, we don't see it anymore, that we can't do anything to test those hypotheses. We can. It's just requires enormous ingenuity, enormous patience, and quite a lot of sophisticated modern techniques.
Thank you. Manfred, I know this is something on which you have a point of view. Would you like to share it with us?
Yeah, I think if we can show that a decision rule in this context, behaving selfishly or altruistically, is hardwired, then we can safely assume it is the product of natural selection. And then we can look up a similar situation in animals. If I come back to my example, we behave altruistically when we have the impression we are observed, either we know it, or we have faint signals of being observed. And these faint signals can be eyes looking at you. And we know from neurophysiological studies that we have specific parts, centers in our brain, which react specifically to a pair of eyes that watches us. And these centers are connected with other centers that organize social behavior. And to show that this is something hardwired and not a conscious decision that we react to eyes staring at us, people have done experiments. For example, Healy and Fessler in North America have shown stylized eyes, a pair of stylized eyes on the computer screen when people were playing a game in which they could either behave altruistically or selfishly. And as soon as these feigned eyes were on the computer screen, they switched to cooperative behavior. And another nice experiment was done by Melissa Bateson and co-workers at the University of Newcastle in Britain. They put pictures of either flowers 1 week or eyes, paintings, above a machine where people in a cafeteria could take tea. And these people were free to pay for the tea or not, because that was not controlled, but they were asked, of course, to pay for the tea. And these people, these researchers, switched week by week from having a picture of flowers to a picture of eyes. And whenever there were the eyes above the machine, then there were a much higher amount of money per liter of milk and tea consumed than when there were flowers. Now, imagine, this is ink on paper, these eyes. Everybody must have recognized this is not a human being watching you. It seems to be an automatic response, as we can track back to the centers in the brain. And now there is a similar thing in words. So this seems to be an old acquirement from our predecessors, which may go back very far to the past. That I would not argue that we have inherited from a common ancestors, the birds and the humans. But this is something we have really evolved and not learned from our social companions.
Thank you, Manfred, and I hope that all parents of teenage children will take note of this.
I'm just wondering if there's any examples in the world where problems of dealing with this have actually been dealt with in some way, such as controlling overfishing in certain parts of the world, or whatever. There's any examples in public policy or whatever that have actually worked?
Of course, if you have a system of control, police, and so on, then you find cooperative behavior as long as the control is efficient. So this tragedy of a commons problem comes up when everybody has free access to a public resource. If you decide what you take and nobody can hinder you, then this comes up. And you can, of course, invent such controlling systems for a lot of these tragedy of a commons problems. But I think the more global the game is, the less probable it is to invent such a control system. So think of controlling the fuel energy consumption of single people all over the world. This is very hard to achieve. So I think, and especially in this case, which is really frightening for our existence, I don't know whether people know that, but we know that we have got time until the year 2050 to reduce the CO2 output globally to 50% from now. If we do not achieve that, then something else than the usual climate change that we experience since 10 years will happen, and this is dangerous climate change. Then the climate can change suddenly and with high speed within 15 years to desert everywhere or to ice everywhere. So we have to solve that. And I think we should take all our imagination into account to find ways to convince people. If it can be done by a police system, that would be the solution, if this can be organized. But I doubt that this can be done in a way that it is efficient enough. We should find other ways of having people cooperating in this game.
Thank you, Manfred. Paul Seabright.
Yes, I just wanted to add to that I think we've learned, particularly in recent years, that effective policing systems are highly decentralized and dispersed. That's to say, they don't just depend on the police in uniform. They depend on the cooperation, on the eyes and ears of a whole decentralized community. Those of you who know the work of the great urbanologist Jane Jacobs, particularly her book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, will recall some of the remarkable descriptions of how the peace and order are kept in a complex urban environment, not just by the policeman in uniform, but by what every neighbor does and what every neighbor sees and what every neighbor talks about. Now, why is that important? It's important because we know that policing, for example, overfishing, works pretty well in small inshore fisheries. I mean, the Maine lobster fisheries are a sort of famous example that is regularly trotted out. And it's not just because they're small, it's because they also harness what turns out to be a remarkably persistent human enthusiasm for watching our neighbors gossiping about them. I won't say spying on them, but at least, let's say, contributing to the cooperative fabric of our collective existence. And that pleasure that we take in watching what our neighbors are up to is something that effective mechanisms for policing cooperation harness. Now, what does that imply for climate change? It implies that it's almost certainly going to be impossible to manage climate change if it relies entirely on formal mechanisms. Those of you who are cynical about sort of, you know, bottom-up change in the environment, I think can take some heart from, or the you can allow your cynicism to be softened by the fact that even though we shall certainly need enforcement mechanisms, carbon taxes, and so on, that those mechanisms will only work if they're underpinned by the enormous decentralized network of enforcement mechanisms, which is in every neighborhood, in every street, in every social community. Whether we can actually mobilize that for these big global commons problems is another matter, but that we need to, that we cannot afford to rely purely on formal policing mechanisms is, I think, inescapable.
Has anyone seen what happens in a public goods game with apes?
Bacteria play public goods games constantly, and they cooperate very nicely. So many bacteria release extracellular products out of the cells, which have a variety of uses, often in pathogenic bacteria. Actually, they're very, very important in getting breaking down the host and making basically the bacteria grow. And these are a public good because while one cell pays the cost of producing them, the other cells can benefit from them. And so it's the problem of cooperation arises there. I have to admit, though, in bacteria, we know it's solved because they're close relatives, generally. And so that's the reason they keep cooperating.
How can we explain behavior that is altruistic towards those that cannot reproduce or no longer even exist? For example, mourning rituals for deceased siblings.
Well, that relates to the issue that I touched on briefly, which was the interesting historical coexistence of ethical and religious systems. I don't want to go very much further into it, but I would direct you to some very interesting work by anthropologists of religion, particularly Scott Atran and Pascal Boyer, who have, I think, done for the study of religion more or less what Chomsky has done for the study of language in the following sense. You might think, looking at the extraordinary range of religious practices across the world, that anything could be a system of religious belief. And what they've both shown, I think, quite convincingly now, is that that's not true. That it's not true that anything can be a language, however varied you might think that the world's languages are. It's not true that anything could be a system of religious belief. Systems of religious belief share a number of very interesting structural characteristics, even though there is an astonishing variety of types of belief systems that would share those characteristics. And in particular, they share the characteristic that spirits, the people, the world of most religious belief systems are rather like real people, but just freed from some of the particular physical restraints that real people suffer. It's very rare to have spirits that move around but are otherwise unrecognizably like human agents. They may be invisible, they may be able to go through walls and so on, but they don't behave in a completely in a way that's completely divorced from human psychology. That means, therefore, that people who have recently deceased are, in a sense, remarkably good candidates for filling that role of the spirits that surround us, because they're very like living people. Indeed, they were very recently living people, and they have merely departed from being living people in one particular dimension. And it's that idea that religious belief systems, in a sense, are peopled by individuals that are just like real people, except in one or two particular dimensions, that I think is the central insight from the Boyer and Atran work. And so, although I think the precise evolutionary story of how those systems came to have such attraction with us still has a lot of work to do, the way in which the ethnography is done and has been ordered and has been systematized has, I think, given us enormous advances along that road, and I think there'll be a lot of things we learn from that in the near future. ¶¶